Corinthians, chapter 9.
Beginning in verse 24. Again, that's 1 Corinthians chapter 9, beginning in verse 24. And I'll be reading from, I believe this is the ESV. It reads, "Do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one receives the prize? So run that you may obtain it. Every athlete exercises self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. So I do not run aimlessly. I do not box as one beating the air. But I discipline my body and keep it under control, lest after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified."
Good morning. Good to see everybody. I want to talk a little bit about self-control today, but just remind us of the six habits that I've been talking about in the last 6 weeks that I've preached, starting with the idea of just being able to be a good worker. These are all habits that I think cross almost every aspect of our life. And so being able to be a good worker and the topic of today about practicing self-control, I think fits every one of the ones above. And so being able to have good self-control to be a good worker, to be a good worker, whether that job or that work is fulfilling you or not. You might catch a little bit of my attitude towards the kind of current concept of work, that it has to be fulfilling me in some way, is a ridiculousness that is only given to those kind of postmodern philosophies and people who can only do that when they have abundance. We have so much abundance that we are able to say, well, I only want to do the work that really fulfills me. Well, when you don't have food for, you don't have food, you don't have money to pay for food, you'll do anything to buy some food so you can eat it. And so sometimes our abundance kind of skews us and deceives us in ways that are not really godly and they're not really healthy. But being able to be a good worker, whether that's as a student, whether that's as a child with your chores, and next week I'm going to get a pick on the parents a little bit. So, and their role in all this stuff. But the idea that every little thing you do at home, you know, the things you do, you know, for a job, the things you do at school or in any aspect of your life, do them diligently. Do them like you would do them for God. That's what God teaches us. And then the idea, and I actually added it this week, purposeful rest. I don't mean I need naps. I mean you purposely setting aside your to-do list, setting aside the work, setting aside the chores, and saying, and remembering what our purpose is. Our purpose isn't about fulfillment in jobs. Our purpose and our fulfillment is about God and remembering God. And as I talked about, you know, resting, remembering God, and rejoicing. These are the things that he commanded them in the Sabbath. And he told them that he gave the Sabbath not because he just wanted people to do follow his command, but he gave the command to help people. And those three things were the focus of his Sabbath rest. And they had to work to take that Sabbath rest. Much like when you want to go on vacation, how much work does it take for you to take a vacation? How much work does it take for you to recover from vacation? They're purposeful. Resting, God commanded these things for us. So if we have a good habit of doing that every week, and they did that always with their family, they always did that. They didn't travel. They didn't take long trips on that day. They spent the day with their family, not working. Nobody working, not even their servants working. Everybody. Nobody, you know, nobody's cooking. Nobody's doing laundry. Nobody's doing anything but gathering together and remembering all that God has given us. And then the third thing I talked about is seeking truth, and I mean that in a really deep way. I don't mean that in just like, I want to just read something. I'm going to look on Wikipedia, you know, and say, see who changed it this week. But the idea of searching things deeper, because we have run into a culture now that is our entire kind of life patterns get us moving from thing to thing very quickly, and we don't spend much time thinking deeply. And there's actually been some studies about that showing that we just spend a lot less time thinking deeply about things. We don't spend a lot of time researching, and we have a lot of memes. They kind of sound good. Maybe they fit sometimes, but they all don't fit other times. I mean, that's the problem of memes. That's a problem of even a proverb. A proverb is a general principle that fits sometimes, but doesn't fit all the time. And it isn't always applicable to every situation. And so we need to be deeper thinkers that seek truth. Because as Jesus told us, it is truth that sets us free. And he is the core of that truth. And then to pray, talking to God all the time. He says continually, regularly. As we looked at the example, you know, in that week, specifically of Daniel, he did it 3 times a day. So much so, his habit was so ingrained that when people wanted to catch him in something bad, they had to get the emperor to create a temporary law that nobody essentially could pray to God for 30 days. And they're like, this is how we catch Daniel. And they caught him right away. Because as soon as he heard about the commandment that the emperor had passed, he went and did it anyway. And he did it with his windows wide open, like he always did, looking towards Jerusalem. And like, well, what happens, happens. He prayed all the time, regardless of whether somebody tells you to not pray or not. And then meditate. And I actually, when I talk about meditating, talking about it last week, the reality is you always do it anyway. But to purposely meditate, plan what you think about. You do lots of meditation. All that time where you're kind of talking to yourself, or you're, you know, you just kind of have that thought, or you have a song that gets stuck in your head. That is a meditation. That is what your brain is doing. It is kind of keeps thinking about it. It keeps, you know, focusing on something, and it keeps bringing it up. And that we are designed to do that. But we are also been gifted by God with the ability to change the focus, to turn it towards those things that are good, to those things that are trustworthy and, you know, good around us, to meditate on anything trustworthy and faithful and good that is in our life. And that's what he tells us to focus on. It's so easy to get caught up in negative things, because negative is what's news, right? Negative is what spreads. It's what negative is what people gossip about. Right? People rarely gossip about all the wonderful things, great things people have done. We don't even usually call it gossip, right? And we're like, wow, they keep telling me how the wonderful things this person keeps doing. It's like, you got to stop spreading those rumors. Because we don't do that much. So coming down to self-control. And all of these things, I think, are based upon James 1, 19 through 25, where it tells us to not just be a hearer of the word, but to be a doer of the word. It is in the doing that we get blessed. And I've talked about it from the beginning. The concept of learning the words of God, hearing the words of God, is a blessing. It changes us. It teaches us. But it is in the practicing of it that we are sowing the godliness, that we are sowing the righteousness. And that's how we reap the godliness after sowing it. If we hear the word of God and we learn from it, but we don't practice it, it doesn't bless us the same. God can grant us mercy. He can grant us forgiveness on our deathbed. But that doesn't mean we have reaped good things in our life. And we have, from having sown them throughout our life. And I used the example last week of Manasseh. Manasseh spent 50 years sowing evil throughout Judah. And yet at the end of his life, he appears to be contrite. And God is willing to give him mercy. But is he going to sow? Did he sow a lot of good? Did he reap a lot of good? No. All he really received was mercy at the end. If you want to live a life that reaps goodness, you need to sow it. You need to practice it. If you want forgiveness, you need to forgive. If you want graciousness, you should be gracious. And that's just how life works. And it works that way in every culture, in every place, and it has always worked that way amongst human beings. So we come to self-control. And I want to talk a quick second about these two images. A couple of things about them. The first one, I really like this idea of the thermostat, and you can kind of dial it. You know, I get you got 0 self-control to 5 self-control. You want to dial it all the way up. But in reality of life, when you're little, think about it from a child. How much self-control do little children have? I mean, like a year old, year and a half old. How much self-control do they have? Essentially 0. You start telling them no, and becomes the word they know the best. For some period of time. Because you're trying to tell them, you can't do that, you can't do that. And they don't really understand why. But then they start learning that, oh, bad things tend to happen to me when I do the things I've been told not to do. This is where self-control starts with somebody teaching you about controlling yourself. But I want you to think about this one concept. And I would like you to think about yourself in a really honest, truthful way. Are you more of a thermostat where you set the temperature of your life and what you're going to do or not do? Or are you more of a thermometer that you tend to fit the temperature around you? And the scriptures talk about this in other ways. But are you somebody who goes along, or are you somebody who people are you're not led by others? Because if you know that about yourself, you also have to be more protective. If you're a thermometer, you have to be much more protective of the situations you put yourself in. But you should understand that about yourself. That's actually one of the questions in the Song of Solomon asked about, you know, a younger sister. You know, is she a wall or is she a door? Is the example used there. And we kind of get that, right? Difference between a wall and a door. And the idea, I think, of thermostat and the thermometer is the same thing. Know that about yourself. The second one is actually a little challenge for you. And so I grabbed that graphic off the internet. And it's actually the definitions of this Greek word for self-control, the virtue of one who masters his desires and passions, who has restraint exercised over one's own impulses, emotions, or desire. That's all accurate, but that word is transliterated improperly. So it is misspelled in English. Those are all kind of transliterated Greek letters. And I'm going to see if you can find out how it's supposed to be spelled. And you can let me know. And extra credit for you, by the way, if you can let me know what's wrong with it. I was actually going to pronounce it for you, but then I realized that kind of give it away. So you can research that. By the way, did anybody ever go look up what's wrong with the blood is thicker than water? And why the teaching of that little proverb, that blood is thicker than water, that what you learn from that phrase, blood is thicker than water, is exactly the opposite of where that phrase originates from. And in fact, that's not the complete phrase. that it was originally. I don't know if everybody ever, I gave you that challenge a few months ago. I don't know if everybody ever went and researched it, find out the origins of that phrase and why it does not mean what you think it means. So, self-control. Proverbs 25, verse 28. Just give a few principles here to start with. It says, a man without self-control is like a city broken into and left without walls. What do you need protection from? Think about that, what he's saying here for a second. You know, we often think about protection of being, we need protection from other people. But what he's really telling you is if you don't have self-control, you're defenseless against being hurt and attacked. Well, how does self-control affect me from others hurting me? The idea is that if you don't have self-control, you're going to hurt yourself. You will damage yourself. You will affect yourself in negative ways throughout your life in such a way that you will often suffer. You won't reap good things from it. You're going to reap difficulty and trouble. If you don't have self-control, you're going to struggle in life. Doesn't matter how smart you are. Doesn't matter how talented you are. It doesn't matter almost any trait that you have. Without self-control, you're going to suffer the consequences of your own actions or inability to stop yourself from doing things you shouldn't do. Because self-control really works in two ways, right? It works to stop myself from doing things I shouldn't, but then it also means doing those things I should. When I know to do something, that I should do something right, and I don't do it, what does Scripture tell us? That's sin as well. Sin isn't just doing things that are wrong. It's knowing that this was the right thing to do and I didn't do it. I missed the mark because I lack self-control. And self-control is the ability to restrain yourself. In fact, one of the passages I didn't talk about too much, it's pretty interesting that I find it interesting that Paul, and I think it's Felix that he was reasoning with about scriptures, and Felix was like, oh, you know, I need you to go away. You're almost making me be a Christian. But he reasoned about self-control with him. And I suspect that has a lot to do with the kind of Greek philosophers. Greek philosophers, one of the main lines of Greek philosophies was Stoicism. And Stoicism thought a lot about the idea of self-control, of restraint, and how to do that, and thought about it and philosophized about that idea at great length. In fact, the emperor Marcus Aurelius wrote extensively on the philosophies of Stoicism in the second half of the second century. Pretty interesting readings if you ever get a chance to read his book on the subjects. Anyway, the Galatians 5:23, that self-control is part of the fruit of the Spirit. So when we think about the fruit of the Spirit, if we are sowing righteousness, if we are learning from God, and we are being taught by God, and we are growing in God, we the fruit should develop in our life. We should have love. We should be loving people. We should have joy. We should have joy all the time, even in the midst of sorrow. And we should have peace, even in the midst of tribulation, right? And that's actually what Jesus told his own disciples before he was crucified, before he went away. He said, I give you my peace, but in this world you're going to have trouble. There will be difficulties. There will be trials. But you can have my peace. We can be patient, and we can be kind, and we can be good, we can be faithful. And faithfulness is not just that I trust God. It's that if I'm really faithful, other people ought to learn that I'm trustworthy, right? Because if I practice faithfulness, I'm faithful to you, not just God, but to you as well. And so he says, gentleness, that these things grow in our life, self-control. And so we know from, you know, a year old when we had no self-control, and I don't know if, you know, a 13-year-old has a whole lot more, but hopefully they have some. But ideally, it continues to grow through our life, that we are able to do those things that we are supposed to do, and that we are able to stop ourselves from doing those things that we shouldn't do. And so, 1 Corinthians 9, already been read for us, but this is where Paul does a little bit more reasoning about it, about the idea of self-control, and he uses the analogy of athletes. I like a lot of different sports, have practiced a lot of them in my life, and I remember, especially in football, kind of being the main one that every time football season came around, you know, those two-a-day practices for a period of time were grueling. you know, a lot of the guys, you know, for, at the beginning of two-a-days, a lot of the guys, you know, were throwing up. and these are young guys. You know, it's tough. It's physically demanding. It's hard. It's hard to do a lot of these sports, athletics. And that's what he's using here. Now, he's using the athletes, by the way, of the ancient Olympic Games. Because the imperishable wreath that he talks about that they were working for is the modern-day equivalent of the gold medal. Now, they didn't give silver medals and bronze medals. There were no. You only won, or you didn't win. And they got a laurel wreath on the head. Today, we give gold medals. When you think about how much does a gold medal affect an athlete who participates in the Olympic Games? Now, they have a lot of professional athletes in there as well. It doesn't probably affect their bottom line checkbook net worth very much. But for a lot of those sports that don't have perfect, you know, you don't, you know, they still have jobs and then they got to practice their sport and they get a gold medal. How much does it change their life? A lot. I mean, you know, all of a sudden people want to come see him, want to talk with him. They want him to give speeches, and they all of a sudden become known and stars. Now, I don't know if all the results of getting a gold medal are all positive, but it has a dramatic effect on the rest of your life. And that's what he's using here as an analogy. And so he says, we know that in a race, all the runners run, but only one receives the prize. He says, so run that you may obtain it. You have to run in such a way that you win. But here's the challenge. You're not competing against anybody else. You're just competing against you. Will you finish the race? You know, the same analogy really used in Hebrews 12, but about, you know, continuing to run the race with endurance. He says, every athlete exercises self-control in all things. If you ever spend any time, you just take any Olympic athlete. It doesn't even really matter if they're like professionals or if they, you know, they're in one of those sports where they still have to have a regular job. You know, maybe, I don't know who has regular jobs. Some of the skiers, maybe some of the archery or something. And it's like, how much do you think they train? How much do you think their training affects how they eat? Do you think it only affects a little portion of their life, or do you think it affects every portion of their life? Of course, most of us know the answer to that. There's every part of their life is planned. Every part of their life has got purpose to it. And they leave aside, like Hebrews 12 talks about, they leave aside the weights that ensnare them and keep them from running the race that they're running. Because they exercise self-control. They They control what they eat, what they do. They control how they sleep. They do all of those things to win a gold medal. How much, and so he's encouraging us to think in this exact same way. How much do you plan every part of your life so that you can spend eternity with God? An imperishable crown. The gold medal, the laurel wreaths, they're all going to go away. But God says, I've got a crown for you that will never go away. How much, how important is that crown to you? Titus chapter 2, and I was actually, there was just a couple of verses I was going to use, but then I realized really this whole section talks about living self-controlled lives. Because I say, well, who does this apply to? And so he starts off and he talks about, as for you, talking to Titus, teach what accords with sound doctrine, or that really means the doctrine that will make people healthy, is the, I think the idea. Older men, and I'm spiritually healthy, that is. Older men are to be sober-minded, dignified, self-controlled. To older men, okay. All you older guys. You know, and we were talking a little bit back there a little bit. Some of these younger guys are starting to get a bit of gray in there as well. Little sign of older men, isn't it? You got to be self-controlled. We expect that. We don't expect it from the one-year-old. We don't expect it from the toddler. We do expect it from older men, don't we? We expect them. I wouldn't point to anybody specifically, Ben. But he goes, he says, older women likewise are to be reverent in behavior, not slanderers, slaves to much wine. They are to teach what is good and so train the young women. So he doesn't mention self-control to the older women. But then he says, you got to teach the young women to love their husbands and children and to be self-controlled. Doesn't that imply she has to do it as well? So we know the older women, and then the younger women have to be taught. And he says, pure, working at home, kind and submissive to their own husbands, that the word of God may not be reviled. Likewise, urge the younger men to be self-controlled. To older men, older women, younger men, you need to be self-controlled. And he goes all through this idea, and he comes down, and he tells Titus to show yourself in all reports to be a model of good works, and in your teaching show integrity, dignity, sound speech that cannot be condemned, so that an opponent may be put to shame, having nothing evil to say about us. Bondservants are to be submissive to their own masters in everything. They are to be well-pleasing, not argumentative, not pilfering, not showing all good faith, so that in everything they may adorn the doctrine of God our Savior. For the grace of God has appeared, bringing salvation for all people. That's Jesus. Training us to renounce ungodliness and worldly passions, to live self-controlled, upright, and godly lives in this present age, waiting for our blessed hope, the appearing of the glory of our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ, who gave himself for us to redeem us from all lawlessness and to purify for himself, a people for his own possession who are zealous for good works. All of us, every last one of us, needs self-control. And by the way, a little kind of foretelling of next week, as a parent, if you don't instill through discipline and training self-control in your children, and you say, well, we'll just let them kind of handle that as adults, you are going to cripple them in a whole bunch of ways. It is very, very hard. If you've been a spoiled kid, and I don't know how many of you would admit to having been a really spoiled kid? Just a few of us. Yeah. A few. Yeah. I mean, my six older siblings could all testify to how much the last two of us, who were quite a bit younger than the oldest six, how spoiled we were. And I think some of that spoiling simply comes from parents who are older being tired. And they're just like, I just don't have it in me to fight that much anymore. And you get, you know, and so we just didn't really get in trouble. But the consequence of that, self-discipline was something that me and my younger brother had to work on a lot as adults. It was hard. It was harder for us to do the things that we should do and to work in a way that was healthy and good. It was harder for us than it was for our older siblings, especially the oldest siblings, who always get it the worst, right? And that they get that discipline. And then the parents tend to kind of, you know, start slacking a little bit. And then sometimes they realize they overdid it. But those first kids are often achievers because they're not having to become adult and still figure out how to control yourself, or at least to the same degree. As parents, you need to help them in these things. Now, I want you to consider, as an example, the tongue. And we're going to look at a few passages in James. He actually talks about the tongue a lot. Not only in chapter 1, talks about in chapter 3 a lot. I'm only going to talk about a single verse. But then he also comes back here in James 5. Wonder how important speech was to James. Right? And James actually, in a lot of his passages here, he seems to be echoing what his brother, Jesus the Christ, had taught about your yes and no. Remember when you're a kid, and kids have a tendency to do this kind of thing, where you say, oh, you know, you tell somebody something, or maybe they cross their fingers behind their back. Oh, you know, I got my fingers crossed, so that one didn't count, you know. Or I didn't say, I didn't swear I was telling the truth. You know, when little kids come up and say, well, oh, yeah, but I swear I'm telling the truth this time. What does that mean about all the other times when you're not swearing your life? And then, you know, the oath that I remember little kids taking in my neighborhood was, you know, sticking a bunch of needles in my eye or something, in my mother's eye, I can't remember exactly. It's like the whole concept of oaths, and by the way, swearing oaths and vows to God was not condemned at all in the law or in the scriptures. And what Jesus was doing when telling them not to, you know, swear oaths, and when James is kind of repeating that, he's not saying, you know, you couldn't vow something. He's simply saying, whenever you say, if you say you'll do something, you'll do it. If you say no, it's no. There's no waffling. I don't have to swear. I don't have to promise. I don't have to, you know, do something else. Anything else besides yes, I'll do it, or no, I won't, means there's a problem with your trustworthiness. And so think about in James 1:26, if anyone thinks he is religious, does not bridle his tongue, but deceives his heart, this person's religion is worthless. No, notice who bridles your tongue. Nobody else does. How successful have you been at bridling other people's tongue? You can't even bridle your own very well, let alone making other people stop talking. You bridle your own tongue, and the purpose for a bridle is not simply to stop something, it's also to direct it in certain ways. The purpose of self-control, as I've said, is not simply to say, no, don't ever do that. Because some people will say, oh, you know, you kind of make a lot of mistakes with your tongue and your mouth and say, oh, I'm just not going to say anything. But that's actually not the ultimate response. You have to train yourself to say the right things, the appropriate thing, at the appropriate time, which the Proverbs talk about, that word fit. You know, it's like apples setting in gold, that the word fits at that moment. And so that's what religion, and when you think about controlling the self, the tongue is the hardest thing to control. James talks about that. He actually talks about that in chapter 3, when he's warning us not all to become teachers, because he says, for we all stumble in many ways, and if anyone does not stumble in what he says, he's a perfect man, able to bridle his whole body. If you can control your tongue, you probably control all parts of your life. And when he says a perfect man, he doesn't mean sinless. He means mature. But that's the idea. That the tongue is hard to control. If you can control it, then you will be doing... And I don't know, what's your habit? Like if you have a whole list of things you need to do, do you tackle the hardest one first? Or do you tackle the easiest one first? I don't know what your habit is. And I change sometimes, by the way. Sometimes I don't feel like doing this stuff, so I get easy stuff out of the way and so I can build up to the hard ones. And other times I'm like, okay, I'm motivated and I hit the hard one first. Because then I know that it's going to be easy after that. The tongue is the hard one. Of everything about your life, controlling your tongue are the hardest things you'll ever do. And you won't ever have to, you'll never be able to stop. You're not going to get to an age where the bridle is no longer needed. In fact, the older we get, sometimes we need it a little more. Most people know that their grandparents or something got to an age when they started saying stuff, they go, you didn't expect to hear that from your grandparents. There's actually a reason for that, kind of a physiological one, but won't go into all that. But people start, there's a couple reasons. There's also the one that you get old enough, you're like, I just don't care what people think anymore. And you start saying whatever you think. And sometimes that gets to be a little too much for others. But controlling the tongue, you're always going to need a bridle on it to get yourself to say the things you should say. And to stop saying the things you shouldn't say. And then chapter 5, then verse 12. And this is where he's essentially almost copying what Jesus had said in the Sermon on the Mount. He says, but above all, my brothers, do not swear either by heaven or by earth or by any other oath, but let your yes be yes and your no be no, so that you may not fall under condemnation. One of the reasons that was an issue, especially when Jesus spoke about it, was they would sometimes say that if you swore an oath in Israel, if you swore an oath by, you know, the temple, but you didn't have to keep that one. But if you swore it by, you know, the ark, I don't, and this may not be the exact, I may not remember all aspects of it. But if you swore by, you know, like the ark of the temple, then okay, you had to keep that. So they had all these weird rules where if you swore it a certain way, well, you could get out of that one. If you swore it a different way, then you had to keep it. It's like, and that's kind of what he's arguing about, that concept that, well, I didn't say, you know, that I swear I'm telling the truth, so that's on you. Like, no, I should be able to believe you without you having to promise you're telling the truth. And he says, but I want to hit at this one thing about your tongue. How many of you in your self-talk tell yourself, I should do this? Everybody here kind of at some point or another tells yourself, I should do this. How many of you consider that your yes to yourself? You'd be well off to keep the word, your own word to yourself. If you're sitting there thinking, I shouldn't do that, do you know what that is? That's actually your conscience. And do you know what God tells you to do about your conscience? Is don't violate it. And if you're sitting there telling yourself, I shouldn't do that, you should stop doing that. And when you fail, then you should just own up to that. Even if nobody else knows but you and God. And if you say, you know what? Tomorrow I am going to eat more healthy. Maybe I don't know what that is. Well, maybe today I have to learn what that is. But do it. Keep your word, even if it's just you. This is a really big thing about self-control. If you can do that, you'll learn. In fact, one of the greatest mistakes, one of the greatest lessons I ever learned about my tongue was committing to a whole bunch of stuff when I was in my 20s. And then having people remind me, you need to do what you said you'd do, even when it hurts, by the way, which Psalm 15 talks about. And you know what that taught me? Is be a lot slower in saying I'll do something. Because if I tell you, I got to think about it. I've got to consider it. My daughter hated that when she was a kid. You know, I always gave her that, well, let me think about that one. Oh, that usually means no. It usually did, but not always. So, but think about your own ability to say yes and to say no and to follow through and do what you said you would do or stop doing what you said you would stop doing. We'll leave it there today. I appreciate your time. We're going to close out. We've got a song selected. And if you need anything, we're always wanting to help anybody who we can serve in some way. If you need anything, we're going to sing 940.